Welcome to Third Angle, where we're going full circle and finding out how to design a waste-free future. I'm your host, Paul Hames from industrial software company PTC. And in this podcast, you'll usually find us on a factory floor or in a cutting-edge lab. But in this special episode of the podcast, we're in the studio as we deep dive into the circular economy. Now, here at Third Angle, we love design that's creating a better world for tomorrow. We've been to visit the people who've used PTC technology to build electric motorcycles, design sustainable homes of tomorrow, and bring electric mobility to communities in rural Africa. Now, not every product itself is inherently sustainable in its purpose, but almost every product has an impact on the environment through its manufacture. Now, when we traditionally think of design and manufacturing, we think of a linear process where raw materials are manufactured, then sold to a consumer who uses them for a while, and then they're eventually thrown away as waste. Now, the circular economy gives us a new way of thinking about building and creating the products of tomorrow, where through thoughtful design, we're able to repair, we're able to reuse or recycle nearly all of the products that we make. And then at the end of their normal use, products are designed to be broken down, to re-enter the system, to be used again. Now, this isn't about minimizing the negative impact of industry, but about completely flipping our way of thinking about industry itself so that it actually becomes sustainable or has a positive net impact on the environment. Now, somebody that knows all about this new way of thinking is Joe Iles from the Ellen MacArthur Foundation. And Joe's challenging the next generation of designers to think about the global economy in a completely different way. So firstly, hello, Joe. Thank you for joining us today. And could you perhaps start by explaining the story behind the Ellen MacArthur Foundation? Tell us about what you do from, let's say, the education piece, but also to influencing stakeholders within industry.
Sure. Well, thanks for having me. The Ellen MacArthur Foundation was set up in 2010 by the round-the-world sailor Ellen MacArthur, one of the most successful solo sailors in history, really. During one of her last round-the-world record-breaking voyages, she started thinking about resources, because when you go around the world, you want to be really fast. And to be fast, you want to be light. So you take with you just what you need to make that voyage around the globe. And you manage that precisely, because if you run out of something, you can't restock. When Ellen was in the Southern Ocean, the closest people to her boat were the people in the International Space Station above her head. So they're obviously not going to be very useful if she runs out of diesel for the generator or food or medical supplies or something like that. Yeah. So it really forced her to grapple with this idea of the notion of finite. And when she stepped back on dry land at the end, she started to ask, well, is our economy any different? How do we run our economy? We have stocks of materials, and we know that some of them are limited, are finite. So what are we going to do about it? And the answer that she kept getting back from speaking to very intelligent people about this topic was, it's going to be okay. We're going to use a bit less and recycle a bit more, which was really unsatisfying for two main reasons. Firstly, does it really get us to a prosperous future? If we think of that as a straight line, take, make, and waste for most of the materials and products we use, yeah. Does that just not stretch the line a little bit further down the track, and we still hit the limits of that model maybe 10, 15, 20, 100 years in the future? So is it a model fit for the future? And then is the call to just use a bit less, do a bit less, is that really inspiring? Is that really a sort of mission? Could we not aspire to have a huge impact on the world, to do more, but make it positive rather than just trying to minimize the bad stuff?
Yeah. Okay. Interesting. And perhaps if you could explain maybe a little bit about your journey.
Sure.
How you came to be part of the foundation.
Yeah. So I finished university in 2010 and was pretty sad, actually. I don't mean to get too morose, but I had gone to university to study history just because I loved it. I was interested in it. And between 2007 and 2008, obviously the financial crash happened. And the mood when I graduated felt like one of just austerity. Well, it was austerity, right? It was cutbacks, and it was pretty dour. I was living at home on the Isle of Wight with my parents, mm. pulling pints in the local pub. Shout out to the Three Bishops. and then I heard of this charity based on the Isle of Wight that was doing something around resources, education, the economy, mm. working a bit with business. And I sort of trotted along and did some homework and ended up being completely captivated by this idea. It feels like, when we'll get more into the concept, I guess, but when you learn or you notice that the world around us is based on this pattern of currently this invented pattern of take, mm. make, waste, yep. this linearity.
Yep.
Once that sort of veil has been lifted, and you see the sort of you see that as a root cause for so many economic, social, environmental problems, then it is inspiring. I think that's a real mission to do something about it.
Mm. Now, we use the term circular economy. Mm. Now, for the listeners, could you perhaps give a perspective on what that means and how is it different perhaps from the world that we're in today?
Yeah. So really we find the easiest way to talk about the circular economy is to think of it as fundamentally different to our current linear economy. So today we take materials out of the ground, we knock them around a bit, turn them into products that are used often for a short amount of time and then are often disposed of.
Yeah.
We often say that most of the materials we use, we lose, and often after just one short use cycle in that current linear economy. That model has worked, and still for some businesses, and for most affluent people, still seems to be working, right? Because they can sort of navigate their way to the stuff that makes them sort of happy or safe or comfortable.
Yeah.
But throughout history, that model has lifted billions of people out of poverty. It's enabled us to have medicines, warm clothes, healthier food, roof over our heads. Not universally, unfortunately, mm. but for many. But that model only really worked when you don't think about the consequences, the environmental consequences, where we put stuff when we no longer want it, and so on. So a circular economy is fundamentally different, and it's inspired by living systems in which that embrace complexity and where there's no waste. And it's really centered on three specific principles: eliminate waste and pollution, so identify and eliminate waste and pollution at source; circulate products and materials at their highest value for as long as possible; and regenerate natural systems, so put back at least as much or more than you take out from the natural ecosystems on which we depend. And do all that by design, so by intention at the start. This isn't about trying to just treat the symptoms of a broken linear economy and just tidy up, but by intention create products, services, materials, systems that are circular by design.
Yeah, okay. I mean, and I think it is a fascinating concept. And I know the butterfly diagram, mm. which was, I believe, created within your foundation.
Well it was. I think the butterfly diagram was I think, first drawn back in 2000 and probably end of 2011 on a napkin. And it owes a lot to biomimicry, to regenerative design, to industrial ecology. So it's, and as you said, the circular economy is not a new idea. It wasn't invented in 2010,
yeah.
but it synthesizes and draws upon lots of other very important schools of thought.
Mm. And I think the thing I find most interesting on the right, if you like, the right wing of the butterfly is the physical products that I think we can all relate to and we can all understand, you know, that we want to keep products working for longer and then make sure things go on to have another life after they've finished their first life. But on the left side, the left wing of the butterfly, this is all about the natural resources. Mm-hmm. And perhaps you could explain a little bit more about how that works to our listeners as well.
Yeah, so as you say, on the right-hand side, we call them technical materials.
Yeah.
And those are things like metals and polymers. And you'd be looking at a number of different routes or pathways there, ranging from recycling, which, whilst it's a starting point for many, should really be the last resort.
Mm.
And then really we'd be looking at those inner loops of a circular economy through things like remanufacturing, refurbishing, repair, redistribution, reuse, maintenance and sharing. And as we get into those tighter loops, what we notice is what we're talking about in sort of layperson terms is let's try and mess with products less. Mm. If you can keep something in service without shipping it around the world or using 100 extra spare parts or a week of labor to do it, then why not do that? Because that's how you preserve the embodied carbon, the embodied energy labor that went into making that into a product in the first place. The biological side, you're right. It's, you know, it's the butterfly diagram makes it look quite simple actually, but it's hugely complex. But we're talking here about in part sort of food and farming systems, agricultural products. But there's more complexity which we've discovered about the famous butterfly diagram over the years, which we grapple with, which is products like what about a wooden house? That's a biological material that then you would want to keep in use and maintain and repair over time. So there is a bit more complexity to it, but with biological materials, really what we want to be doing is ensuring that when we take them and harvest them or process them, we're not then adding something that means that they can't return to the to the soil or the ecosystem from where they came. And that's something that I think gets missed. I think sometimes people think, well, you know, that cotton's been grown or that meat came from an animal, so it can just go back in, right? And it's not quite that simple. That we need to be very conscious that whether if we add some dyes or some chemicals to those natural materials, they may not be able to return to that system, and they may have impacted the ability for that system to be truly regenerative. Mm-hmm. So obviously crops are grown now, which is a good thing, but the way that we grow them, we need huge amounts of fertilizer and pesticides to keep that profitable. And soil health is massively degraded. So so actually, even though, you know, it might seem rosy because these are natural products and natural materials, a huge amount of thinking and effort needs to go into making that regenerative rather than equally as degrading as a copper mine or something like that.
Really interesting. Now I'd like to, if I can, turn to that sort of technical side of the butterfly diagram and just start perhaps at the beginning where we are developing a product. As many of our listeners are, they're technical people, they're innovators. Can you explain a little bit about the principles of the circular economy when you start actually on that journey of bringing a product to market, you know, and what are the principles that we're trying to get across and trying to adopt at that point in time?
Yeah. So at the stage of designing anything, we say the designers, and why I work with designers and try and, as you said at the top of the show, why we try and inspire that community is that the decisions that are made at the design stage influence how we make and use things. And once those decisions have been made, they're really hard to reverse. So if you think about, I always think of something like ocean plastic. It's unfortunately, the more I read about it, the more it seems unimaginable that we could ever extract all the plastic that's reached the ocean already. But it's completely, I mean, these are challenges at different scales, admittedly, but it's completely feasible to imagine a packaging model, business model that never leaks past plastic to the ocean. So that's why it sounds sort of obvious, and I'm sure will be obvious to many listeners, but that's why design is so important. In terms of the actual principles, one thing we try and do is sort of avoid getting stuck or racing straight to certain strategies. So with the circular economy, often you hear about repair or remanufacturing or renting a product rather than selling it, or recycling or smarter materials choices. Those all might be the answer, but the method that you might apply for a bicycle that's designed for shared use versus a piece of packaging for some crisps or a house, they're obviously going to be different, different strategies. So what we try and encourage people to do, and we produced a report earlier this year called From Ambition to Action, an adaptive strategy for circular design, because we tried to lay out six design skills that practitioners can use to really sort of lay the groundwork for truly impactful circular economy innovation. And they were: understand the system, set your vision, build capability, create space for collaboration, use tools, and set and respond to rules. Mm. And we can go into more detail on some of those, but really what we aim to do there is to say, this is how you really unlock the power of the design team, because designers are doing all those things at different levels already.
Yeah.
And what the designers that we speak to, they want to use their skills to, at a more strategic level, to support the shift to a circular economy, rather than just saying, you know, here's this product. Can we make it with 50% recycled material rather than 10?
Yep.
So really, we think that those what designers can do is kind of goes a bit deeper than just tweaking the materials constitution or making something a bit repairable or something like that.
Yeah, and I think we see a lot of our customers looking at a holistic way of embedding better practice, better circularity practice at that design stage. It may be that they're trying to lightweight the product. It may be that they're making less prototypes and they're using simulation so that the product, they know the product's going to work when it gets out there, and they know it's going to be suitable for the lifespan that was intended. And so I think there's a lot of that, together with the material choices and manufacturing processes, there's a lot of that that our customers are already doing. Understanding the carbon debt associated with the supply chain, all of those things, I think, from our side as well, are really important from a capability perspective. You mentioned tools, Joe. You know, that really is the bit where we fit, I think, and where our tools impact. And we have a responsibility to deliver those tools to our our customers.
Well, let's think about lightweighting for a second, because that's a really interesting example. Yep. I forget the exact percentages here, but and the dates. I mean, I'm not actually a very good historian, but I think from roughly like 1970 to today, the average washing up liquid bottle had something like a 50-60% reduction in weight,
right?
Through very smart material science, engineering, maybe some additives to the plastic, which meant it could still perform its tasks in durability and waterproofing, for example, but with using less material, which sounds like a good thing, but the potential impact of that over time is that each unit of packaging is worth less than than before, which means that the economics of recycling become a bit screwed, actually.
Right.
So these are the things that we do sort of encourage designers and the organizations of which they are a part to watch out for. And that's why if someone's using tools and a certain tool that's helping them reach some very specific goal around lightweighting or something like that, we'd also say, well, look at that in the context of that vision or understand the system, because it would be unhelpful to proceed down a particular innovation pathway and then realize we're sort of stuck now because we've had some unintended consequences which we never imagined. So that's why that sort of systemic understanding, that vision setting piece, is also really important.
Yes, and I think when we look at the circular economy model, there are a number of perhaps what appear to be counterintuitive motions, approaches.
Yeah.
One of them, you touched on it earlier, Joe, was this idea that we want to keep the product working longer.
Mm-hmm.
We want to keep it going. We want to make it, keep it maintained, make sure that it's out there so that the energy and the embedded carbon that was used during creating the product, that stays in the market longer. Now, that might appear counterintuitive, but we see a lot of companies today moving from selling the product to selling the product as a service. Mm-hmm. And if you can sell the product as a service, and then you're able to keep that running longer, it's good for you as a manufacturer, good for the customer, and obviously it's all part of that circular economy model as well.
Exactly, that paying for performance, not just the product itself.
Yeah.
It also shifts the incentives for making a durable product away from, shifts it towards the manufacturer, because if I'm making printers and I could get that item back 10 or 20 times and effectively sell it to 10 or 20 different customers with mostly the same materials, then that, I mean, I haven't done the numbers on that, but that seems like a good idea. In fact, we, in our, some of our earlier reports, we did the numbers for things like washing machines and like commercial vehicles, and and it stacks up pretty well. So that's absolutely part of it. That business model shift.
And I think you touched on the, you know, printer manufacturers. We've got a very interesting customer down in Spain who make 3D printers.
Oh yeah,
but they embed all of that circularity information right at the design stage, and that lives with the product during its life. So when that printer, parts of that printer, sub-assemblies and so forth, reach the end of that life, they can easily access this piece needs to go back because it's going to be remanufactured. This piece becomes, it's recycled. This piece, unfortunately, you know, there's no real reuse for it. But everything is stamped and labeled.
Yeah.
And this is an area that I know, you know, will develop, and partly because of regulation. And I think with the EU's move for the digital product passport, I think that's a really important step in the right direction. Could you maybe explain a little bit about that, Joe, in terms of what that means and what it's intended to do?
Yeah, so my understanding of the digital product passport is that it's a method to provide data for products. I believe the categories haven't been totally pinned down yet, or the priority order of the different categories of products. Yeah. That data is then stored in the cloud and is accessed through something like a QR code for different stakeholders along the supply chain. So it could be end of life or repair or something like that. And this is not a completely new topic. At policy level, it's gaining traction, which is fantastic. But one of the first case studies that I think I wrote when joining the Ellen MacArthur Foundation was for a ship, the Maersk Triple E liner, which is such a gargantuan cargo ship. And the ambition there was, they were saying, well, there's a problem currently. A big boat like that would usually have a lifespan of about 20 years. There's 7 different grades of steel on that vessel. But at the end of life, it goes to a beach somewhere and it gets broken up, but they lose track of those different grades of steel. So it all gets merged into one pretty low grade steel, which then it's not worth that much.
Yeah.
So the product passport, even for that, an item of that size, would aim to say, well, if at the end of life we could at least say, here is the high grade steel, here's the low grade steel and everything in between, then we could keep that material in use at the same level of performance.
Yep.
So these ideas, you know, they're not altogether new, and it's an interesting observation, I think, that technological innovation often outpaces systems innovation. So most of the technology that we need to build elements of the circular economy into our world today, that exists, but the system is not really, it's certainly underdeveloped, and actually the lock-ins of today's linear system, all the incentives that mean it's harder to break from that take-make-waste model than it is to stick with it. That means that progress on some of these things is, you know, 20, 30 years in the making.
Yeah. And I think, again, that is where I think, you know, regulatory bodies, that's where government absolutely have a role to play in driving this and forcing the hand of industry, because all of this makes sense. And like you said, it's a big shift. It's highly disruptive.
Yeah.
And therefore, you know, companies will get there, but it's how quickly they'll get there. And we really need to drive that agenda.
That's true. I think that's definitely true. And policymakers can absolutely align incentives, level playing fields. They can also pull customers to new behaviors or ensure that products with a sort of circular potential reach that potential, whether that's the France's repair indicators that they now have on some products, or I think in Austria they'll give a bit of a almost like a mini grant for people who want to repair a product rather than chucking it out. But then we should also think that smartphones were not they've sort of changed everything, but they weren't forced by regulation. Regulation enabled some of the technology that, which like GPS and things like that, but a lot of those innovations are a product of technological developments and really good marketing. I think one thing that we need to factor into this transformation to a circular economy, or we need to think about, is how we make it really appealing, how we present it as a desirable life. I mean, the idea of owning a car, a house, and a dog, or whatever. Like there have been times when marketing people have created a vision of what a prosperous, happy life looks like, and there's a huge opportunity now to shape that around a different set of needs, those that are connected to the circular economy.
But I think that leads us into another area that I'd just like to touch on, Joe, which is this notion of reverse logistics and how we actually get products that are at the end of their life. How we understand how we get them back to do things with them. Mm-hmm. I think it's a tricky challenge. You know, we're very good at sort of the, you know, actually shipping products, but we've now got to bring things back so that the right sort of handling and behavior can happen at the end of life. Perhaps you could just touch on a few things there.
Well, you make me think of one of my early trips with the Ellen MacArthur Foundation to a car manufacturer.
Yep.
And we went around the factory floor for the new cars for a couple of hours, and it was mind-blowing. Like these hugely automated, clean and shiny, and hundreds of parts and cars rolling off the production line every day. And then we left, and they said, would you like to see our remanufacturing facility? Mm. And we went around the corner, and there was sort of a shed with two blokes hitting a car with a hammer, basically. And it was that was a decade ago, and I'm sure that facility has moved on since, but it did make me realize that this is sort of what we're up against. As you said, the outward flow of stuff is hugely efficient and optimized, and we've had decades of practice to get that working by some measure really, really well. The reverse cycle for so many types of product is a cottage industry in comparison, or it has been. So that needs huge amounts of thinking and investment to make that as sophisticated as that outward cycle, so that it can sort of compete. And again, that comes back to design. I think, I mean, the smartphone gets a lot of, is sort of, in some ways, a bit of a, it's quite symbolic for this, yes, we can repair. I mean, I don't know, I've smashed my phone once or twice in my history of owning a phone.
Yeah, sure.
And you can get it repaired, but it's not necessarily easy, because they've been designed using adhesive and, proprietary screws, and maybe the technology, the software gets a bit screwed when you take it apart or something like that.
Yep.
So I can sort of understand why for the past few years, OEMs have also not really wanted to do that.
Yeah.
Why would we want to get our stuff back? It's a nightmare. Yes. Think how many people we'd have to employ to repair all that.
Yeah.
But if you, by intention, designed that because you knew that you were going to get those items back, then, or you were renting it, so your business model depended on you being able to keep that sort of core, as you said, with the automotive parts in service for longer, then you would make different design decisions.
No, I think, as you say, it all goes back to the business model and that vision that a company has. And again, we've got customers, you know, that are, you know, really at the forefront of sort of their carbon debt reduction, zero waste by 2050. And those are all really fantastic targets to have. And a lot of companies working really hard in that direction.
I mean, Caterpillar are famous for it, really.
Yeah.
So whether that's I think, well, I spoke to someone from Caterpillar, again, many years ago at a remanufacturing summit. And I was surprised at the size of the deposit they put on the engines for these industrial engines.
Yeah.
It was almost 50% of the cost, I think. Right. I don't know if that is true now, but it was so big because they wanted to ensure that every single one of those was returned to them. Yes.
So I think we've touched on some really interesting topics there around the beginning of life of a product, the middle of life, keeping it running, and then obviously the end of life and what happens to it. Can we just touch a little bit on the education that the Ellen MacArthur Foundation are doing in terms of how you go out to industry, out to schools, out to universities, and teach them about these principles?
Yeah, so I mean, you said it. We work, we take a quite a broad view of learning and where that happens and with who. We do some work with schools. We work with a number of universities, and we have since the start, universities like Cranfield and many more. And then a lot of our effort is on building capabilities, inspiring and building capabilities within businesses. So we have a network of around 200 businesses, both large and small, that we work with. Mm-hmm. We host events for them where we bring them all together. We encourage them to network and to collaboratively problem solve. They form projects between like-minded companies or companies with shared challenges.
Yeah.
We produce a range of educational materials, whether those are courses that they can do or assets they can download and things like that. So, and then we also sort of extend our view of learning to digital marketing and social media. I mean, we think you start learning if you read a tweet that says what the three principles of a circular economy are. So we really try and guide people through different layers of understanding. We know that not everyone on the planet needs to understand deeply what a circular economy is with all its systemic implications and complexity. Yeah. But we do think that it's a really compelling idea that at its, you know, people sometimes say circles, the economy is not going to be a circle. It's not that simple. And of course, it's not that simple. There's unimaginable complexity. But the idea of a circle is so simple and universal, something without a beginning and an end, that anyone can really get it. So to that end, we produce a huge number of podcasts. We've been producing something called the Circular Economy Show, which is a live sort of magazine format show from our office on the Isle of Wight. So it's a really broad range of materials, from insights and reports through to really digestible story driven stuff, through to workshops and more hands on activities.
Okay. Yeah, really interesting. And I think perhaps if we think about drawing things to a close and think about perhaps some final messages for our listeners, many of whom are design practitioners, they're industrial designers, engineers, innovators. What would be your final message to them, Joe, in terms of what you'd like them to take away from today's conversation?
My final message would be to look at what they're working on right now, or the last thing that they designed or were involved in designing, and just ask, what happens next? And keep asking that until you think you've illuminated as much of the system around that thing as you can, to the limits of your awareness or understanding. And the reason I say that is that I think the real superpower for the circular economy is understanding systems, or scrutinizing the world around us and asking, what's the system in which they sit? And that understanding that will lead you to the right sort of answers, or maybe even asking better questions. So I'd encourage people to say, ask, what next? Where did the materials come from? Where are they going to end up? Who's going to use this after the first person's finished with it? How will it be repaired? How will it be repaired? Will it end up in this country or another country? Will the cap of this bottle end up somewhere different from the bottle itself? Keep asking that question, and I think people will be surprised at how many sort of follow-on questions, how much information they can build around something as simple as a plastic bottle, a pair of jeans, or a ham sandwich. So asking questions, and especially that question of what happens next, I think is something that everyone can do and is the best starting point.
Yeah. And as you say, it starts with the vision, doesn't it? It starts with that ethos that you need to adopt and embed in all of your thinking. And I think that is a great message to perhaps sign off with. So Joe, thank you so much for your time today.
It's been a
fascinating conversation, really insightful in terms of the practices that we need to be thinking about and adopting to really drive this forward.
Brilliant. Thanks for having me.
Okay, thank you. Please rate, review, and subscribe to our bi-weekly Third Angle episodes wherever you listen to your podcasts, and follow PTC on LinkedIn and Twitter for future episodes.